Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is what's most convenient for you. Care is being here when you need us. We're open evenings and weekends. Care is helping you save more. Most insurance plans and discount cards are accepted at your local Kroger Pharmacy. Care is saving you time by managing your prescriptions online. You can request refills, check order status, and more. Care is convenience that works for everyone. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Services and availability vary by location. Age and other restrictions may apply. For coverage, consult your health insurance company. Visit the pharmacy or our site for details.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For further information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Andy Minter. Four Max Carrados Detective Stories by Ernest Brahmer. The Coin of Dionysius. It was 8 o'clock at night and raining, scarcely a time when a business so limited in its clientele as that of a coin dealer could hope to attract any customer. But a light was still showing in the small shop that bore over its window the name of Baxter, and in the even smaller office at the back, the proprietor himself sat reading the latest Pall Mall. His enterprise seemed to be justified, for presently the doorbell gave its announcement, and throwing down his paper, Mr. Baxter went forward. As a matter of fact, the dealer had been expecting someone, and his manner as he passed into the shop was unmistakably suggestive of a caller of importance. But at the first glance towards his visitor, the excess of deference melted out of his bearing, leaving the urbane, self-possessed shopman in the presence of the casual customer.
"Mr. Baxter, I think," said the latter. He had laid aside his dripping umbrella, and was unbuttoning overcoat and coat to reach an inner pocket. "You hardly remember me, I suppose. Mr. Carlyle, 2 years ago I took up a case for you."
"To be sure. Mr. Carlyle, the private detective."
"Inquiry agent,"
corrected Mr. Carlyle precisely.
"Well," smiled Mr. Baxter, "for that matter, I am a coin dealer and not an antiquarian or a numismatist. Is there anything in that way that I can do for you?"
"Yes,"
replied his visitor.
"It's my turn to consult you."
He had taken a small wash-leather bag from the inner pocket and now turned something carefully out upon the counter.
"What can you tell me about that?"
The dealer gave the coin a moment's scrutiny.
"There's no question about this," he replied. "It's a Sicilian tetradrachm of Dionysius."
"Yes, I know that. I have it on the label out of the cabinet. I can tell you further that it's supposed to be the one that Lord Seastoke gave £250 for at the Bryce sale in 94.
"It seems to me that you can tell me more about it than I can tell you,"
remarked Mr. Baxter.
"What is it that you really want to know?"
"I want to know," replied Mr. Carlyle, "whether it's genuine or not."
"Has any doubt been cast upon it?"
"Certain circumstances raised a suspicion. That's all."
The dealer took another look at the tetradrachm through his magnifying glass, holding it by the edge with the careful touch of an expert. Then he shook his head slowly in a confession of ignorance.
"Of course, I could make a guess."
"No, don't,"
interrupted Mr. Carlyle hastily.
"An arrest hangs on it, and nothing short of certainty is any good to me."
"Is that so, Mr. Carlyle?"
said Mr. Baxter, with increased interest.
"Well, to be quite candid, the thing is out of my line. Now, if it was a rare Saxon penny or a doubtful noble, I'd stake my reputation on my opinion. But I do very little in the classical series."
Mr. Carlyle did not attempt to conceal his disappointment as he returned the coin to the bag and replaced the bag in the inner pocket.
"I had been relying on you,"
he grumbled reproachfully.
"Where on earth am I to go now?" "There is always the British Museum." "Ah, to be sure, thanks. But will anyone who can tell me be there now?"
"Now? No fear,"
replied Mr. Baxter. "Go round in the morning."
"But I must know to-night," explained the visitor, reduced to despair again. "Tomorrow will be too late for the purpose."
Mr. Baxter did not hold out much encouragement in the circumstances.
"You can scarcely expect to find anyone at business now," he remarked. "I should have been gone these 2 hours myself, only I happened to have an appointment with an American millionaire who fixed his own time."
Something indistinguishable from a wink slid off Mr. Baxter's right eye.
"Offmanson, he's called, and a bright young pedigree hunter has traced his descent from Offer, King of Mercia. So he quite naturally wants a set of offers as a sort of collateral proof."
"Very interesting,"
murmured Mr. Carlyle, fidgeting with his watch.
"I should love an hour's chat with you about your millionaire customers some other time. Just now... Now, look here, Baxter, can't you give me a line of introduction to some dealer in this sort of thing who happens to live in town? You must know dozens of experts."
"Why, bless my soul, Mr. Carlyle, I don't know a man of them away from his business," said Mr. Baxter, staring. "They may live in Park Lane, or they may live in Petticoat Lane, for all I know. Besides, there aren't so many experts as you seem to imagine, and the two best would very likely quarrel over it. You've had to do with expert witnesses, I suppose."
"I don't want a witness. There'll be no need to give evidence. All I want is an absolutely authoritative pronouncement that I can act on. Is there no one who can really say whether the thing is genuine or not?"
Mr. Baxter's meaning silence became cynical in its implication as he continued to look at his visitor across the counter. Then he relaxed.
"Stay a bit. There is a man, an amateur, I remember hearing wonderful things about some time ago. They say he really does know."
"There you are," explained Mr. Carlyle, much relieved. "There always is someone. Who is he?"
"Funny name," replied Baxter. "Something Wynne, or Wynne something."
He craned his neck to catch sight of an important motor car that was drawing to the curb before his window.
"Wynne Carrados. You'll excuse me now, Mr. Carlyle, won't you? This looks like Mr. Offmanson."
Mr. Carlyle hastily scribbled the name down on his cuff.
"Wynne Carrados. Right. Where does he live?" "Haven't the remotest idea," replied Baxter,
referring the arrangement of his tie to the judgment of the wall mirror.
"I've never seen the man myself. Now, Mr. Carlyle, I'm sorry. I can't do any more for you. You won't mind, will you?"
Mr. Carlyle could not pretend to misunderstand. He enjoyed the distinction of holding open the door for the transatlantic representative of the line of offer as he went out, and then made his way through the muddy streets back to his office. There was only one way of tracing a private individual at such short notice, through the pages of the directories, and the gentleman did not flatter himself by a very high estimate of his chances. Fortune favoured him, however. He very soon discovered a Wynne Carrados living at Richmond, and better still, further search failed to unearth another. There was, apparently, only one householder, at all events, of that name in the neighbourhood of London. He jotted down the address and set out for Richmond. The house was some distance from the station, Mr. Carlyle learned. He took a taxicab and drove, dismissing the vehicle at the gate. He prided himself on his power of observation and the accuracy of his deductions, which resulted from it a detail of his business. "It's nothing more than using one's eyes and putting two and two together," he would modestly declare, when he wished to be deprecatory rather than impressive. By the time he had reached the front door of The Turrets, he had formed some opinion of the position and tastes of the people who lived there. A man-servant admitted Mr. Carlyle and took his card, his private card, with the bare request for an interview that would not detain Mr. Carrados for 10 minutes. Luck still favoured him. Mr. Carrados was at home and would see him at once. The servant, the hall through which they passed, and the room into which he was shown, all contributed something to the deductions which the quietly observant gentleman was half unconsciously recording.
"Mr. Carlyle," announced the servant. The room was a library or study. The only occupant, a man of about Carlyle's own age, had been using a typewriter up to the moment of his visitor's entrance. He now turned and stood up with an expression of formal courtesy.
"It's very good of you to see me at this hour,"
apologised Mr. Carlyle.
The conventional expression of Mr. Carrados's face changed a little. "Surely my man has got your name wrong," he explained. "Isn't it Louis Culling?" Mr. Carlyle stopped short, and his agreeable smile gave place to a sudden flash of anger or annoyance.
"No, sir," he replied stiffly. "My name is on the card which you have before you."
"I beg your pardon," said Mr. Carrados, with perfect good humour. "I hadn't seen it. But I used to know a Culling some years ago at St. Michael's."
"St. Michael's?"
Mr. Carlyle's features underwent another change, no less instant and sweeping than before.
"St. Michael's? Wynne Carrados? Good heavens, it isn't Max Wynne? Old Winning Wynne?"
"A little older and a little fatter, yes," replied Carrados. "I have changed my name, you see."
"Extraordinary thing, meeting like this,"
said his visitor, dropping into a chair and staring hard at Mr. Carrados.
"I have changed more than my name. How did you recognise me?"
"The voice," replied Carrados. "It took me back to that little smoke-dried attic den of yours where we..."
"My God!" exclaimed Carlyle bitterly. "Don't remind me of what we were going to do in those days."
He looked round the well-furnished, handsome room and recalled other signs of wealth that he had noticed.
"At all events, you seem fairly comfortable, Wynne."
"I am alternately envied and pitied," replied Carrados, with a placid tolerance of circumstance that seemed characteristic of him. "Still, as you say, I am fairly comfortable."
"Envied, I can understand. But why are you pitied?"
"Because I am blind," was the tranquil reply.
"Blind?"
exclaimed Mr. Carlyle, using his own eyes superlatively.
"Do you mean literally blind?"
"Literally. I was riding along a bridle path through a wood about a dozen years ago with a friend. He was in front. At one point a twig sprang back. You know how easily a thing like that happens. It just flicked my eye. Nothing to think twice about."
"And that blinded you?"
"Yes, ultimately. It's called amaurosis."
"I can scarcely believe it. You seem so sure and self-reliant. Your eyes are full of expression. Only a little quieter than they used to be. I believe you were typing when I came. Aren't you having me?"
"You miss the dog and the stick?" smiled Carrados. "No, it's a fact."
"What an awful affliction for you, Max. You were always such an impulsive, reckless sort of fellow. Never quiet. You must miss such a fearful lot."
"Has anyone else recognised you?" asked Carrados quietly.
"Ah, that was the voice, you said,"
replied Carlyle. "Yes, but other people hear the voice as well. Only I had no blundering, self-confident eyes to be hoodwinked."
"That's a rum way of putting it," said Carlyle. "Are your ears never hoodwinked, may I ask?"
"Not now, nor my fingers, nor any of my other senses that have to look out for themselves."
"Well, well,"
murmured Mr. Carlyle, cut short in his sympathetic emotions.
"I'm glad you take it so well. Of course, if you find it an advantage to be blind, old man..."
He stopped and reddened.
"I beg your pardon,"
he concluded stiffly. "Not an advantage, perhaps," replied the other thoughtfully. "Still, it has its compensations that one might not think of. A new world to explore, new experiences, new powers awakening, strange new perceptions, life in the fourth dimension. But why do you beg my pardon, Louis?"
"I'm an ex-solicitor, struck off in connection with the falsifying of a trust account, Mr. Carrados,"
replied Carlyle, rising. "Sit down, Louis," said Carrados suavely. His face, even his incredibly living eyes, beamed placid good-nature. "The chair on which you will sit, the roof above you, all the comfortable surroundings to which you have so amiably alluded, are the direct result of falsifying a trust account. But do I call you Mr. Carlyle in consequence? Certainly not, Louis."
"I did not falsify the account,"
cried Carlyle hotly. He sat down, however, and added more quietly,
"But why do I tell you all this? I've never spoken of it before."
"Blindness invites confidence," replied Carrados. "We are out of the running. Human rivalry ceases to exist. Besides, why shouldn't you? In my case, the account was falsified."
"Of course, that's all bunkum, Max,"
commented Carlyle.
"Still, I appreciate your motive."
practically everything I possess was left to me by an American cousin, on the condition that I took the name of Carrados. He made his fortune by an ingenious conspiracy of doctoring the crop reports and unloading favourably in consequence, and I need hardly remind you that the receiver is equally guilty with the thief.
But twice as safe. I know something of that, Max. Have you any idea what my business is?
You shall tell me, replied Carrados.
I run a private inquiry agency. When I lost my profession, I had to do something for a living. This occurred. I dropped my name, changed my appearance, and opened an office. I knew the legal side down to the ground, and I got a retired Scotland Yard man to organise the outside work.
Excellent, cried Carrados. Do you unearth many murders?
No,
admitted Mr. Carlyle.
Our business lies mostly on the conventional lines among divorce and defalcation.
That's a pity, remarked Carrados. Do you know, Louis, I always had a secret ambition to be a detective myself. I have even thought lately that I might still be able to do something at it if the chance came my way. That makes you smile?
Well, certainly the idea.
Yes, the idea of a blind detective, the blind tracking the alert.
Of course, as you say, certain facilities are no doubt quickened,
Mr. Carlyle hastened to add considerately.
But seriously, with the exception of an artist, I don't suppose there is any man who is more utterly dependent on his eyes.
Whatever opinion Carrados might have held privately, his genial exterior did not betray a shadow of dissent. For a full minute he continued to smoke, as though he derived an actual visual enjoyment from the blue sprays that travelled and dispersed across the room. He had already placed before his visitor a box containing cigars of a brand which that gentleman keenly appreciated, but generally regarded as unattainable. And the matter-of-fact ease and certainty with which the blind man had brought the box and put it before him had sent a questioning flicker through Carlyle's mind. "You used to be rather fond of art yourself, Louis," he remarked presently. "Give me your opinion of my latest purchase, the bronze lion on the cabinet there." Then, as Carlyle's gaze went about the room, he added quickly, "No, not that cabinet, the one on your left." Carlyle shot a sharp glance at his host as he got up, but Carrados's expression was merely benignly complacent. Then he strolled across to the figure.
"Very nice,"
he admitted.
"Late Flemish, isn't it?"
"No, it's a copy of Vidal's Roaring Lion."
"Vidal?"
"A French artist." The voice became indescribably flat. "He also had the misfortune to be blind, by the way."
"You old humbug, Max!" shrieked Carlyle. "You've been thinking that out for the last 5 minutes."
Then the unfortunate man bit his lip and turned his back towards his host. "Do you remember how we used to pile it up on that obtuse ass Sanders and then roast him?" asked Carrados, ignoring the half-smothered exclamation with which the other man had recalled himself.
"Yes,"
replied Carlyle quietly.
"This is very good,"
he continued, addressing himself to the bronze again.
"However did he do it?"
"With his hands."
"Naturally. But I mean, how did he study his model?"
"Also with his hands. He called it seeing near."
"Even with a lion? Handled it?"
"In such cases he required the service of a keeper who brought the animal to bay while Vidal exercised his own particular gifts. You don't feel inclined to put me on the track of a mystery, Louis?" Unable to regard this request as anything but one of old Max's unquenchable pleasantries, Mr. Carlyle was on the point of making a suitable reply, when a sudden thought caused him to smile knowingly. Up to that point he had indeed completely forgotten the object of his visit. Now that he remembered the doubtful Dionysius and Baxter's recommendation, he immediately assumed that some mistake had been made. Either Max was not the Wynne Carrados he had been seeking, or else the dealer had been misinformed, for although his host was wonderfully expert in the face of his misfortune, it was inconceivable that he could decide the genuineness of a coin without seeing it. The opportunity seemed a good one of getting even with Carrados by taking him at his word.
"Yes,"
he accordingly replied, with crisp deliberation as he recrossed the room.
"Yes, I will, Max. Here is the clue to what seems to be a rather remarkable fraud."
He put the tetradrachm into his host's hand.
"What do you make of it?"
For a few seconds Carrados handled the piece with the delicate manipulation of his fingertips, while Carlyle looked on with a self-appreciative grin. Then, with equal gravity, the blind man weighed the coin in the balance of his hand. Finally he touched it with his tongue.
"Well?"
demanded the other. "Of course I have not much to go on, and if I was more fully in your confidence I might come to another conclusion."
"Yes, yes,"
interposed Carlyle with amused encouragement. "Then I should advise you to arrest the parlourmaid, Nina Brun. Communicate with the police authorities of Padua for particulars of the career of Helene Brunesi, and suggest to Lord Seastoke that he should return to London to see what further depredations have been made in his cabinet." Mr. Carlyle's groping hand sought and found a chair, onto which he dropped blankly. His eyes were unable to detach themselves for a single moment from the very ordinary spectacle of Mr. Carrados's mildly benevolent face, while the sterilised ghost of his now forgotten amusement still lingered about his features.
"Good heavens!" he managed to articulate. "How do you know?"
"Isn't that what you wanted of me?" asked Carrados suavely.
"Don't humbug, Max," said Carlyle severely. "This is no joke."
An undefined mistrust of his own powers suddenly possessed him in the presence of this mystery.
"How do you come to know of Nina Brum and Lord Seastoke?"
"You're a detective, Louis," replied Carrados. "How does one know these things? By using one's eyes and putting two and two together." Carlyle groaned and flung out an arm petulantly.
"Is it all bunker, Max? Do you really see all the time? Though that doesn't go very far towards explaining it."
"Like Vidal, I see very well at close quarters," replied Carrados, lightly running a finger along the inscription on the tetradrachm. "For longer range, I keep another pair of eyes. Would you like to test them?" Mr. Carlyle's assent was not very gracious. It was, in fact, faintly sulky. He was suffering the annoyance of feeling distinctly unimpressive in his own department. But he was also curious. "The bell is just behind you, if you don't mind," said his host. "Parkinson will appear. You might take a note of him while he's in." The man who had admitted Mr. Carlyle proved to be Parkinson. "This gentleman is Mr. Carlyle, Parkinson," explained Carrados the moment the man entered. "You will remember him for the future?" Parkinson's apologetic eye swept the visitor from head to foot, but so lightly and swiftly that it conveyed to that gentleman the comparison of being very deftly dusted.
"I will endeavour to do so, sir,"
replied Parkinson, turning again to his master. "I shall be at home to Mr. Carlyle whenever he calls. That's all."
"Very well, sir."
"Now, Louis," remarked Mr. Carrados briskly when the door had closed again, "you have had a good opportunity of studying Parkinson. What's he like?"
"In what way?"
"I mean as a matter of description. I'm a blind man. I haven't seen my servant for 12 years. What idea can you give me of him? I asked you to notice."
"I know you did, but your Parkinson is the sort of man who has very little about him to describe. He's the embodiment of the ordinary. His height's about average."
5'9", murmured Carrados, "slightly above the mean."
"Scarcely noticeably so. Clean-shaven, medium brown hair, no particularly marked features, dark eyes, good teeth."
"False," interposed Carrados. "The teeth, not the statement."
"Possibly,"
admitted Mr. Carlyle.
"I'm not a dental expert, and I had no opportunity of examining Mr. Parkinson's mouth in detail. But what is the drift of all this?"
"His clothes?"
"Oh, just the ordinary evening dress of a valet. There's not much room for variety in that."
"You noticed, in fact, nothing special by which Parkinson could be identified?"
"Well, he wore an unusually broad gold ring on the little finger of the left hand."
"But that is removable. And yet Parkinson has an ineradicable mole. The small one, I admit, on his chin. And you a human sleuth-hound. Oh, Louis!"
"At all events,"
retorted Carlyle, writhing a little under this good-humoured satire, although it was easy enough to see in it Carrados's affectionate intention.
"At all events, I dare say I can give as good a description of Parkinson as he can of me."
That is what we are going to test. Ring the bell again.
Seriously?
Quite. I am trying my eyes against yours. If I can't give you 50 out of 100, I'll renounce my private detectorial ambition for ever.
It isn't quite the same,
objected Carlyle, but he rang the bell. Come in and close the door, Parkinson, said Carrados when the man appeared. Don't look at Mr. Carlyle again. In fact, you had better stand with your back towards him. He won't mind. Now, describe to me his appearance as you observed it. Parkinson tendered his respectful apologies to Mr. Carlyle for the liberty he was compelled to take by the deferential quality of his voice.
Mr. Carlyle, sir, wears patent leather boots of about size 7 and very little used. There are 5 buttons, but on the left boot, 1 button, the third up, is missing, leaving loose threads and not the more usual metal fastener. Mr. Carlyle's trousers, sir, are of a dark material, a dark grey line of about a quarter of an inch width on a darker ground. The bottoms are turned permanently up, and are just now a little muddy, if I may say so.
Very muddy, interposed Mr. Carlyle generously. It is a wet night, Parkinson.
Yes, sir, very unpleasant weather. If you will allow me, sir, I will brush you in the hall. The mud is dry now, I notice. Then, sir, continued Parkinson, reverting to the business in hand, there are the dark green cashmere hose. A curb pattern keychain passes into the left-hand trouser pocket.
From the visitor's nether garments, the photographic-eyed Parkinson proceeded to higher ground, and with increasing wonder, Mr. Carlyle listened to the faithful catalogue of his possessions. His fetter and link Albert of gold and platinum was minutely described. His spotted blue ascot with its gentlemanly pearl scarf-pin was set forth, and the fact that the buttonhole in the left lapel of his morning coat showed signs of use was duly noted. What Parkinson saw he recorded, but he made no deductions. A handkerchief carried in the cuff of the right sleeve was simply that to him, and not an indication that Mr. Carlyle was, indeed, left-handed. But a more delicate part of Parkinson's undertaking remained. He approached it with a double cough.
As regards Mr. Carlyle's personal appearance, sir...
No, enough, cried the gentleman concerned hastily. I am more than satisfied. You are a keen observer, Parkinson.
I have trained myself to suit my master's requirements, sir,
replied the man. He looked towards Mr. Carrados, received a nod, and withdrew. Mr. Carlyle was the first to speak.
"That man of yours would be worth £5 a week to me, Max," he remarked thoughtfully. "But of course—"
"I don't think that he would take it," replied Carrados in a voice of equally detached speculation. "He suits me very well. But you have the chance of using his services, indirectly."
"You still mean that, seriously?"
"I notice in you a chronic disinclination to take me seriously, Louis. It really is, to an Englishman, almost painful. Is there something inherently comic about me, or the atmosphere of the turrets?"
"No, my friend," replied Mr. Carlyle, "but there is something essentially prosperous. That's what points to the improbable. Now, what is it?"
"It might be merely a whim, but it's more than that," replied Carrados. "It's, well, partly vanity, partly ennui, partly—" certainly there was something more nearly tragic in his voice than comic now— "partly hope." Mr. Carlyle was too tactful to pursue the subject.
"Those are 3 tolerable motives," he acquiesced. "I'll do anything you want, Max, on one condition."
"Agreed. And it is?"
"That you tell me how you knew so much of this affair."
He tapped the silver coin which lay on the table near them.
"I'm not easily flabbergasted," he added.
"You won't believe that there's nothing to explain, that it was purely second sight?"
"No,"
replied Carlyle tersely.
"I won't."
"You're quite right. And yet the thing is very simple."
"They always are, when you know," soliloquised the other. "That's what makes them so confoundedly difficult when you don't."
"Here is this one, then. In Padua, which seems to be regaining its old reputation as the birthplace of spurious antiques, by the way, there lives an ingenious craftsman named Pietro Stelli. This simple soul, who possesses a talent not inferior to that of Cavino at his best, has for many years turned his hand to the not unprofitable occupation of forging rare Greek and Roman coins. As a collector and student of certain Greek colonials, and a specialist in forgeries, I have been familiar with Stelli's workmanship for years. Latterly, he seems to have come under the influence of an international crook called, at the moment, Dompierre, who soon saw a way of utilising Stelli's genius on a royal scale. Hélène Brunetti, who in private life, and really is, I believe, Madame Dompierre, readily lent her services to the enterprise.
"Quite so,"
nodded Mr. Carlyle, as his host paused. "You see the whole sequence, of course?"
"Not exactly, not in detail," confessed Mr. Carlyle.
Dompierre's idea was to gain access to some of the most celebrated cabinets of Europe and substitute Stelli's fabrications for the genuine coins. The princely collection of rarities that he would thus amass might be difficult to dispose of safely, but I have no doubt that he had matured his plans. Hélène, in the person of Nina Brun, an anglicised French parlourmaid, a part which she fills to perfection, was to obtain wax impressions of the most valuable pieces, and to make the exchange when the counterfeits reached her. In this way it was obviously hoped that the fraud would not come to light until long after the real coins had been sold, and I gather that she has already done her work successfully in general houses. Then, impressed by her excellent references and capable manner, my housekeeper engaged her, and for a few weeks she went about her duties here. It was fatal to this detail of the scheme, however, that I have the misfortune to be blind. I am told that Hélène has so innocently angelic a face as to disarm suspicion, but I was incapable of being impressed, and that good material was thrown away. But one morning my material fingers, which of course knew nothing of Hélène's angelic face, discovered an unfamiliar touch about the surface of my favourite Euclideas. And although there was doubtless nothing to be seen, my critical sense of smell reported that wax had recently been pressed against it. I began to make discreet inquiries, and in the meantime my cabinets went to the local bank for safety. Hélène countered by receiving a telegram from Angers, calling her to the deathbed of her aged mother. The aged mother succumbed, duly compelled Hélène to remain at the side of her stricken patriarchal father, and doubtless the Turrets was written off the syndicate's operations as a bad debt.
"Very interesting," admitted Mr. Carlyle. "But at the risk of seeming obtuse,"
his manner had become delicately chastened,
"I must say that I fail to trace the inevitable connection between Nina Brun and this particular forgery, assuming that it is a forgery."
"Set your mind at rest about that, Louis," replied Carrados. "It is a forgery, and it is a forgery that none but Pietro Stelli could have achieved. That is the essential connection. Of course there are accessories. A private detective coming urgently to see me with a notable tetradram in his pocket, which he announces to be the clue to a remarkable fraud. Well, really, Louis, one scarcely needs to be blind to see through that."
"And Lord Seastoke? I suppose you happened to discover that Nina Brun had gone there?"
"No, I cannot claim to have discovered that, or I should certainly have warned him at once when I found out, only recently, about the gang. As a matter of fact, the last information I had of Lord Seastoke was a line in yesterday's Morning Post, to the effect that he was still at Cairo. But many of these pieces," he brushed his finger almost lovingly across the vivid chariot race that embellished the reverse of the coin, and broke off to remark, "You really ought to take up the subject, Louis. You have no idea how useful it might prove to you some day."
"I really think I must," replied Carlyle grimly. £250 the original of this one cost, I believe."
"Cheap, too. It would make £500 in New York today. As I was saying, many are literally unique. This gem by Kimon is..." Here is his signature, you see. "Peter is particularly good at lettering. And as I handled the genuine tetradram about 2 years ago, when Lord Seastoke exhibited it at a meeting of our society in Albemarle Street, there is nothing at all wonderful in my being able to fix the locale of your mystery. Indeed, I feel that I ought to apologise for it all being so simple."
"I think,"
remarked Mr. Carlyle, critically examining the loose threads on his left boot, "that the apology on that head would be more appropriate from me." End of The Coin of Dionysius. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For further information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Andy Minter. Four Max Carrados Detective Stories by Ernest Brammer. 2. The Knight's Cross Signal Problem. "Louis," exclaimed Mr. Carrados, with the air of genial gaiety that Carlyle had found so incongruous to his conception of a blind man, "you have a mystery somewhere about you. I know it by your step." Nearly a month had passed since the incident of the false Dionysius had led to the two men meeting. It was now December. Whatever Mr. Carlyle's step might indicate to the inner eye, it betokened to the casual observer the manner of a crisp, alert, self-possessed man of business. Carlyle, in truth, betrayed nothing of the pessimism and despondency that had marked him on the earlier occasion. "You have only yourself to thank that it's a very poor one," he retorted. "If you hadn't held me to a hasty promise to give me an option on the next case that baffled you, no matter what it was..." "Just so. The consequence is that you get a very unsatisfactory affair that has no special interest to an amateur, and is only baffling because it is... Well, baffling?" "Exactly, Max. Your would-be jest has discovered the proverbial truth. I need hardly tell you that it is only the insoluble that is finally baffling. And this is very probably insoluble. You remember the awful smash on the Central and Suburban at Knight's Cross Station a few weeks ago?"
"Yes," replied Carrados, with interest. "I read the whole ghastly details at the time."
"You read?" exclaimed his friend suspiciously.
"I still use the familiar phrases," explained Carrados with a smile. "As a matter of fact, my secretary reads to me. I mark what I want to hear, and when he comes at 10 o'clock, we clear off the morning papers in no time."
"And how do you know what to mark?"
demanded Mr. Carlyle cunningly. Carrados's right hand, lying idly on the table, moved to a newspaper near. He ran his finger along a column heading, his eyes still turned towards his visitor. "The Money Market, continued from page 2, British Railways," he announced.
"Extraordinary," murmured Carlyle.
"Not very," said Carrados. "If someone dicked a stick in treacle and wrote rats across a marble slab, you would probably be able to distinguish what was there blindfold."
"Probably," admitted Mr. Carlyle. "At all events, we will not test the experiment."
"The difference to you of treacle on a marble background is scarcely greater than that of printer's ink on newspaper to me. But anything smaller than pica I do not read with comfort, and below long primer I cannot read at all. Hence the secretary. Now, the accident, Louis."
"The accident. Well, you remember all about that. An ordinary Central and Suburban passenger train, non-stop at Knight's Cross, ran past the signal and crashed into a crowded electric train that was just beginning to move out. It was like sending a garden roller down a row of hand lights. Two carriages of the electric train were flattened out of existence. The next two were broken up. For the first time on an English railway, there was a good stand-up smash between a heavy steam engine and a train of light cars, and it was bad for the coup.
27 killed, 40-something injured. 8 died since," commented Carrados.
"That was bad for the company," said Carlyle. "Well, the main fact was plain enough. The heavy train was in the wrong. But was the engine driver responsible? He claimed, and he claimed vehemently from the first, and he never varied one iota, that he had a clear signal, that is to say, the green light, it being dark. The signalman concerned was equally dogged that he never pulled off the signal, that it was at danger when the accident happened, and that it had been for 5 minutes before. Obviously they could not both be right.
"Why, Louis?" asked Mr. Carrados smoothly.
"The signal must either have been up or down, red or green."
"Did you ever notice the signals on the Great Northern Railway, Louis?"
"Not particularly. Why?"
"One wintry day, about the year when you and I were concerned in being born, the engine driver of a Scotch express received a clear from a signal near a little Huntingdon station called Abbott's Ripton. He went on and crashed into a goods train, and into the thick of the smash a down express mowed its way, 13 killed and the usual tale of injured. He was positive that the signal gave him a clear. The signalman was equally confident that he had never pulled it off the danger. Both were right, and yet the signal was in working order. As I said, it was a wintry day, it had been snowing hard, and the snow froze and accumulated on the upper edge of the signal arm until its weight bore it down. That is a fact that no fiction writer dare have invented, but to this day every signal on the Great Northern pivots from the centre of the arm instead of from the end, in memory of that snowstorm."
"That came out at the inquest, I presume," said Mr. Carlyle. "We have had the Board of Trade inquiry and the inquest here, and no explanations forthcoming. Everything was in perfect order. It rests between the word of the signalman and the word of the engine driver. Not a jot of direct evidence either way. Which is right?"
"That is what you're going to find out, Louis?" suggested Carrados.
"It's what I'm being paid for finding out," admitted Mr. Carlyle frankly. "But so far we're just where the inquest left it, and between ourselves I candidly can't see an inch in front of my face in the matter."
"Nor can I," said the blind man, with a rather wry smile. "Never mind. The engine driver is your client, of course."
"Yes," admitted Carlyle. "And how the deuce did you know?"
"Let us say that your sympathies are enlisted on his behalf. The jury were inclined to exonerate the signalman, weren't they? What has the company done with your man?"
"Both are suspended. Hutchins, the driver, hears that he may probably be given charge of a lavatory at one of the stations. He's a decent, bluff, short-spoken old chap with his heart in his work. Just now you'll find him at his worst, bitter and suspicious. The thought of swabbing down a lavatory and taking pennies all day is poisoning him."
"Naturally. Well, there we have an honest Hutchins, taciturn, little touchy perhaps, grown grey in the service of the company, and manifesting quite a bulldog-like devotion to his favourite 538.
"Why, that actually was the number of his engine. How do you know it?"
demanded Carlyle sharply. "It was mentioned two or three times at the inquest, Louis," replied Carrados mildly.
"And you remembered? With no reason to?"
"You can generally trust a blind man's memory, especially if he has taken the trouble to develop it."
"Then you will remember that Hutchins did not make a very good impression at the time. He was surly and irritable under the ordeal. I want you to see the case from all sides."
"He called the signalman, Mead, a lying young dog across the room, I believe. Now, Mead, what is he like? You've seen him, of course."
"Yes, he does not impress me favourably. He's glib, ingratiating, and distinctly greasy. He has a ready answer for everything, almost before the question's out of your mouth. He's thought of everything."
"And now you're going to tell me something, Louis," said Carrados encouragingly. Mr. Carlyle laughed a little, to cover an involuntary movement of surprise.
"There is a suggestive line that was not touched at the inquiries,"
he admitted.
"Hutchins has been a saving man all his life, and he's received good wages. Among his class he's regarded as wealthy. I dare say that he has £500 in the bank. He's a widower with one daughter, a very nice mannered girl of about 20. Mead's a young man, and he and the girl are sweethearts, have been informally engaged for some time. But old Hutchins would not hear of it. He seems to have taken a dislike to the signalman from the first, and latterly he had forbidden him to come to his house or his daughter to speak to him."
"Excellent, Louis," cried Carrados in great delight. "We shall clear your man in a blaze of red and green lights yet, and hang the glib, greasy signalman from his own signal-post."
"It is a significant fact, seriously?"
"It is absolutely convincing."
"It may have been a slip, a mental lapse on Mead's part, which he discovered the moment it was too late. And then, being too cowardly to admit his fault, and having so much at stake, he took care to make detection impossible. It may have been that, but my idea is rather that probably it was neither quite pure accident nor pure design. I can imagine Mead meanly pluming himself over the fact that the life of this man who stands in his way, and whom he must cordially dislike, lies in his power. I can imagine the idea becoming an obsession as he dwells on it. A dozen times, with his hand on the lever, he lets his mind explore the possibilities of a moment's defection. Then one day he pulls the signal off in sheer bravado, and hastily puts it at danger again. He may have done it once, or he may have done it oftener, before he was caught in a fatal moment of irresolution. The chances are about even that the engine driver would be killed. In any case, he'd be disgraced, for it's easier on the face of it to believe that a man might run past a danger signal in absent-mindedness without noticing it, than that a man should pull off a signal and replace it without being conscious of his actions.
The fireman was killed. Does your theory involve the certainty of the fireman being killed, Louis?
No,
said Carlyle.
The fireman's a difficulty. But looking at it from Mead's point of view, whether he's been guilty of an error or a crime, it resolves itself into this. First, the fireman may be killed. Second, he may not notice the signal at all. Third, in any case, he will loyally corroborate his driver, and a good old jury will discount that.
Carrados smoked thoughtfully, his open, sightless eyes merely appearing to be set in a tranquil gaze across the room. "It would not be an improbable explanation," he said presently. 99 men out of 100 would say, "People do not do these things." But you and I, who have in our different ways studied criminology, know that they sometimes do, or else there would be no curious crimes. What have you done on that line?" To anyone who could see, Mr. Carlyle's expression conveyed an answer.
"You're behind the scenes, Max. What was there for me to do? Still, I must do something for my money. Well, I've had a very close inquiry made confidentially among the men. There might be a whisper of one of them knowing more than had come out, a man restrained by friendship or enmity or even great jealousy. Nothing came of that. Then there was the remote chance that some private person had noticed the signal, without attaching any importance to it then. One who would be able to identify it still by something associated with the time. I went over the line myself. Opposite the signal, the line on one side is shut in by a high blank wall. On the other side are houses. But coming below the butt end of a scullery, the signal doesn't happen to be visible from any road or any window."
"My poor Louis," said Carrados in friendly ridicule, "you were at the end of your tether."
"I was," admitted Carlyle. "And now that you know the sort of job it is, I don't suppose that you're keen on wasting your time over it."
"That would hardly be fair, would it?" said Carrados reasonably. "No, Louis, I will take over your honest old driver, and your greasy young signalman, and your fatal signal that cannot be seen from anywhere."
"But it is an important point for you to remember, Max, that although the signal cannot be seen from the box, if the mechanism had gone wrong, or anyone tampered with the arm, the automatic indicator would at once have told me that the green light was showing. Oh, I've gone very thoroughly into the technical points, I assure you."
"I must do so too," commented Mr. Carrados gravely.
"For that matter, if there's anything you want to know, I dare say that I can tell you,"
suggested his visitor.
"It might save your time."
"True," acquiesced Carrados. "I should like to know whether anyone belonging to the houses that bound the line there came of age or got married on the 26th of November." Mr. Carlyle looked across curiously at his host.
"I really do not know, Max,"
he replied in his crisp, precise way.
"What on earth has that got to do with it, may I inquire?"
The only explanation of the Pont St. Lin swing-bridge disaster of 75 was the reflection of a green Bengal light on a cottage window. Mr. Carlyle smiled his indulgence privately.
"My dear chap, you mustn't let your retentive memory of obscure happenings run away with you,"
he remarked wisely.
"In 9 cases out of 10, the obvious explanation is the true one. The difficulty, as here, lies in proving it.
Now, would you like to see these men? I expect so. In any case, I will see Hutchins first. Both live in Holloway. Shall I ask Hutchins to come here to see you, say, tomorrow? He's doing nothing. No, replied Carrados. Tomorrow I must call on my brokers, and my time may be filled up. Quite right. You mustn't neglect your own affairs for this experiment, assented Carlyle. Besides, I should prefer to drop in on Hutchins at his own home. Now, Louis, enough of the honest old man for one night. I have a lovely thing by Eumenes that I want to show you. Today is Tuesday. Come to dinner on Sunday and pour the vials of your ridicule on my want of success. That's an amiable way of putting it, replied Carlyle. All right, I will. 2 hours later, Carrados was again in his study, apparently, for a wonder, sitting idle. Sometimes he smiled to himself, and once or twice he laughed a little, but for the most part his pleasant, impassive face reflected no emotion, and he sat with his useless eyes tranquilly fixed on an unseen distance. It was a fantastic caprice of the man to mock his sightlessness by a parade of light, and under the soft brilliance of a dozen electric brackets the room was as bright as day. At last he stood up and rang the bell. "I suppose Mr. Greatorex isn't still here by any chance, Parkinson?" he asked, referring to his secretary.
"I think not, sir, but I will ascertain,"
replied the man. "Never mind. Go to his room and bring me the last two files of The Times. Now, when he returned, turn to the earliest you have there. The date?
November the 2nd.
That will do. Find the money market. It will be in the supplement. Now, look down the columns until you come to British Railways.
I have it, sir.
Central and Suburban. Read the closing price and the change.
Central and Suburban Ordinary. 66.5 to 67.5, all 1/8. Preferred Ordinary, 81 to 81.5, no change. Deferred Ordinary, 27.5 to 27.75, fall 1/4. That is all, sir.
Now take a paper about a week on. Read the deferred only.
27 to 27.25, no change.
Another week?
29.5 to 30, rise 5/8.
Another?
31.5 to 32.5, rise 1.
Very good. Now, on Tuesday the 27th of November.
31.78, 32.75, rise 1/2.
Yes, the next day?
24.5 to 23.5, fall 9.
Quite so, Parkinson. There had been an accident, you see.
Yes, sir, very unpleasant accident. Jane knows a person whose sister's young man has a cousin who had his arm torn off in it. Torn off at the socket, she says, sir. Seems to bring it home to one, sir.
That is all. Stay, in the paper you have, look down the first money column and see if there is any reference to the Central and Suburban.
Yes, sir. City and Suburban, which after their late depression on the projected extension of the motor bus service, had been steadily creeping up on the abandonment of the scheme, and as a result of their own excellent traffic returns, suffered a heavy slump through the lamentable accident of Thursday night. The deferred in particular at one time fell 11 points, as it was felt that the possible dividend, with which rumour has of late been busy, was now out of the question.
Yes, that is all. Now you can take the papers back. And let it be a warning to you, Parkinson, not to invest your savings in speculative railway deferreds.
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir. I will endeavour to remember.
He lingered for a moment as he shook the file of papers level.
I may say, sir, that I have my eye on a small block of cottage property at Acton. But even cottage property scarcely seems safe from legislative depredation now, sir.
The next day Mr. Carrados called on his brokers in the city. It is to be presumed that he got through his private business quicker than he expected, for after leaving Austin Friars he continued his journey to Holloway, where he found Hutchins at home and sitting morosely before his kitchen fire, rightly assuming that his luxuriant car would involve him in a certain amount of public attention in Klondike Street. The blind man dismissed it some distance from the house, and walked the rest of the way, guided by the almost imperceptible touch of Parkinson's arm.
"Here is a gentleman to see you, father,"
explained Miss Hutchins, who had come to the door. She divined the relative position of the two visitors at a glance.
"Then why don't you take him into the parlour?"
grumbled the ex-driver. His face was a testimonial of hard work and general sobriety, but at the moment one might hazard from his voice and manner that he had been drinking earlier in the day.
"I don't think the gentleman would be impressed by the difference between our parlour and our kitchen," replied the girl quaintly. "And it is warmer here. What's the matter with the parlour now?"
demanded her father sourly.
"It was good enough for your mother and me. It used to be good enough for you. There is nothing the matter with it, nor with the kitchen either."
She turned impassively to the two, who had followed her along the narrow passage.
"Will you go in, sir?" "I don't want to see no gentleman,"
cried Hutchins noisily.
"Unless..."
His manner suddenly changed to one of pitiable anxiety.
"Unless you're from the company, sir, to...
"No, I have come on Mr. Carlyle's behalf," replied Carrados, walking to a chair as though he moved by a kind of instinct. Hutchins laughed his wry contempt.
"Mr. Carlyle,"
he reiterated.
"Mr. Carlyle, a fat lot of good he's been. Why don't he do something for his money?"
"He has," replied Carrados, with imperturbable good humour. "He has sent me. Now, I want to ask you a few questions."
"A few questions?"
roared the irate man.
"Why, blast it, I've done nothing else but answer questions for a month. I didn't pay Mr. Carlyle to ask me questions. I can get enough of that for nixes. Why don't you go and ask Mr. Herbert Ananias Mead your few questions? Then you might find out something."
There was a slight movement by the door, and Carrados knew that the girl had quietly left the room.
"You saw that, sir?"
demanded the father, diverted to a new line of bitterness.
"You saw that girl, my own daughter, that I've worked for all her life?"
"No," replied Carrados.
"That girl has just gone out. She's my daughter,"
explained Hutchins. "I know, but I did not see her. I see nothing. I am blind."
"Blind?"
exclaimed the old fellow, sitting up in startled wonderment.
"You mean it, sir? You walk all right, and you look at me as if you saw me. You're kidding, surely?"
"No," smiled Carrados. "It is quite right."
"Then it's a funny business, sir. You what are blind, expecting to find something that those with their eyes couldn't,"
ruminated Hutchins sagely. "There are things that you can't see with your eyes, Hutchins."
"Perhaps you're right, sir. Well, what is it you want to know?"
"Light a cigar first," said the blind man, holding out his case and waiting until the various sounds told him that his host was smoking contentedly. "The train you were driving at the time of the accident was the 6:27 from Notcliffe. It stopped everywhere until it reached Lambeth Bridge, the chief London station on your line. There it became something of an express, and leaving Lambeth Bridge at 7:11 should not stop again until it fetched Swanstead-on-Thames, 11 miles out at 7:34. Then it stopped on and off from Swanstead to Ingerfield, the terminus of that branch, which it reached at 8:05. Hutchins nodded, and then, remembering, said,
"That's right, sir."
"That was your business all day, running between Notcliffe and Ingerfield?"
"Yes, sir. 3 journeys up and 3 down, mostly."
"With the same stops on all the down journeys?"
"No, the 7:11 is the only one that does a run from the bridge to Swanstead. You see, it is just on the close of the evening rush, as they called it. A good many late business gentlemen living at Swanstead use the 7:11 regular. The other journeys we stop at every station to Lambeth Bridge, and then here and there beyond."
"There are, of course, other trains doing exactly the same journey, a service, in fact."
"Yes, sir, about 6.
"And do any of those, say, during the rush, do any of those run non-stop from Lambeth to Swanstead?" Hutchins reflected a moment. All the choler and restlessness had melted out of the man's face. He was again the excellent artisan, slow but capable and self-reliant.
"That I couldn't definitely say, sir. Very few short-distance trains pass the junction, but some of those may. A guide would show us in a minute, but I haven't got one."
"Never mind. You said at the inquest that it was no uncommon thing for you to be pulled up at the stop signal east of Knight's Cross Station. How often would that happen? Only with the 7:11, mind."
"Perhaps 3 times a week, perhaps 2.
"The accident was on a Thursday. Have you noticed that you were pulled up oftener on a Thursday than on any other day?" A smile crossed the driver's face at the question.
"You don't happen to live at Swanstead yourself, sir?"
he asked in reply.
"No," admitted Carrados. "Why?"
"Well, sir, we were always pulled up on Thursday. Practically always, you may say. You got to be quite a saying amongst those that used the train regular. I used to look out for it."
Carrados's sightless eyes had the one quality of concealing emotion supremely. "Oh," he commented softly, "always. And it was quite a saying, was it? And why was it always so on Thursday?"
"It had to do with the early closing, I'm told. The suburban traffic was a bit different. By rights, we ought to have been set back 2 minutes for that day, but I suppose it wasn't thought worth while to alter us in the timetable, so we most always had to wait outside 3 Deep Tunnel for a westbound electric to make good."
"You were prepared for it, then?"
"Yes, sir, I was,"
said Hutchins, reddening at some recollection.
"And very down about it was one of the jury over that. But mayhap once in 3 months I did get through Haven on a Thursday. And it's not for me to question whether things are right or wrong just because they're not what I may expect. The signals are my orders, sir. Stop, go on. And it's for me to obey as you would a general on the field of battle. What would happen otherwise? It was nonsense what they said about going cautious, and the man who stated it was a barber who didn't know the difference between a distance and a stop signal down to the minute they gave their verdict. My orders, sir, given me by that signal, was go right ahead and keep to your running time."
Carrados nodded a smoothing assent. "That's all, I think," he remarked.
"All?" exclaimed Hutchins in surprise. "Why, sir, you can't have got much of an idea of it yet."
"Quite enough. And I know it isn't pleasant for you to be taken along the same ground over and over again." The man moved awkwardly in his chair and pulled nervously at his grizzled beard.
"You mustn't take any notice of what I said just now, sir,"
he apologised.
"You somehow make me feel that something might come of it. But I've been badgered about and accused and cross-examined from one to another of them these weeks till it fair makes me bitter against everything. And now they talk of putting me in a lavatory, me that has been with the company for 45 years and on the footplate 32. A man suspected of running past a danger signal."
"You have had a rough time, Hutchins. You will have to exercise your patience a little longer yet," said Carrados sympathetically.
"You think something might come of it, sir? You think you'll be able to clear me? Believe me, sir, if you could give me something to look forward to, it might save me from..."
He pulled himself up and shook his head sorrowfully.
"I've been near it,"
he added simply. Carrados reflected and took his resolution. "Today's Wednesday. I think you may hope to hear something from your general manager towards the middle of next week."
"Good God, sir, you really mean that?"
"In the interval, show your good sense by behaving reasonably. Keep civilly to yourself and don't talk. Above all," he nodded towards a quart jug that stood on the table between them, an incident that filled the simple-minded engineer with boundless wonder when he recalled it afterwards, "above all, leave that alone." Hutchins snatched up the vessel and brought it crashing down on the hearthstone, his face shining with a set resolution.
"I've done with it, sir. It was a bitterness and despair that drove me to that. Now I can do without it."
The door was hastily opened, and Miss Hutchins looked anxiously from her father to the visitors and back again.
"Oh, whatever is the matter?"
she exclaimed.
"I heard a great crash. This gentleman is going to clear me, Meg, my dear,"
blurted out the old man irrepressibly.
"And I've done with that drink for ever."
"Hutchins, Hutchins," said Carrados warningly.
"My daughter, sir, you wouldn't have her not now,"
pleaded Hutchins, rather crestfallen.
"He won't go any further."
Carrados laughed quietly to himself as he felt Margaret Hutchins' startled and questioning eyes attempting to read his mind. He shook hands with the engine driver without further comment, however, and walked out into the commonplace little street under Parkinson's unobtrusive guidance. "Very nice of Miss Hutchins to go into half-mourning, Parkinson," he remarked as they went along, thoughtful and yet not ostentatious.
"Yes, sir,"
agreed Parkinson, who had long ceased to wonder at his master's perceptions. The Romans, Parkinson, had a saying to the effect that gold carries no smell. That is a pity sometimes. What jewellery did Miss Hutchins wear?
Very little, sir. A plain gold brooch representing a merry thought. The merry thought of a sparrow, I should say, sir. The only other article was a smooth-backed gunmetal watch suspended from a gunmetal bow.
Nothing showy or expensive, eh?
Oh, dear, no, sir. Quite appropriate for a young person of her position.
Just what I should have expected. He slackened his pace. We are passing a hoarding, are we not?
Yes, sir.
We will stand here a moment. Read me the letterpress of the poster before us.
This Oxo one, sir?
Yes.
Oxo, sir?
Carrados was convulsed with silent laughter. Parkinson had infinitely more dignity, and conceded merely a tolerant recognition of the ludicrous. "That was a bad shot, Parkinson," remarked his master when he could speak. "We will try another." For 3 minutes, with scrupulous conscientiousness on the part of the reader, and every appearance of keen interest on the part of the hearer, there were set forth the particulars of a sale by auction of superfluous timber and builder's material. "That will do," said Carrados, when the last detail had been reached. "We can be seen from the door of number 107 still?"
"Yes, sir."
"No indication of anyone coming to us from there?"
"No, sir."
Carrados walked thoughtfully on again. In the Holloway Road they rejoined the waiting motor car. "Lambeth Bridge Station," was the order the driver received. From the station the car was sent on home, and Parkinson was instructed to take 2 first-class singles for Richmond, which could be reached by changing at Stafford Road. The evening rush had not yet commenced, and they had no difficulty in finding an empty carriage when the train came in. Parkinson was kept busy that journey, describing what he saw at various points between Lambeth Bridge and Knight's Cross. For 1/4 mile, Carrados's demands on the eyes and the memory of his remarkable servant were wide and incessant. Then his questions ceased. They had passed the stop signal east of Knight's Cross Station. The following afternoon they made the return journey as far as Knight's Cross. This time, however, the surroundings failed to interest Carrados. "We are going to look at some rooms," was the information he offered on the subject, and an imperturbable
"Yes, sir,"
had been the extent of Parkinson's comment on the unusual proceeding. After leaving the station, they turned sharply along a road that ran parallel with the line, a dull thoroughfare of substantial elderly houses that were beginning to sink into decrepitude. Here and there a corner residence displayed the brass plate of a professional occupant, but for the most part they were given up to the various branches of second-rate apartment letting.
"The third house after the one with the flagstaff," said Carrados.
Parkinson rang the bell, which was answered by a young servant, who took an early opportunity of assuring them that she was not tidy, as it was rather early in the afternoon. She informed Carrados, in reply to his inquiry, that Miss Chubb was at home, and showed them into a melancholy little sitting-room to await her appearance. "I shall be almost blind here, Parkinson," remarked Carrados, walking about the room. "It saves explanation."
"Very good, sir," replied Parkinson.
5 minutes later, an interval suggesting that Miss Chubb also found it rather early in the afternoon, Carrados was arranging to take rooms for his attendant and himself for the short time that he would be in London, seeing an oculist. "One bedroom, mine, must face north," he stipulated. "It has to do with the light." Miss Chubb replied that she quite understood. Some gentlemen, she added, had their requirements, others their fancies. She endeavoured to suit all. The bedroom she had in view from the first did face north. She would not have known, only the last gentleman, curiously enough, had made the same request. "A sufferer like myself?" inquired Carrados affably. Miss Chubb did not think so. In his case, she regarded it merely as a fancy. He had said that he could not sleep on any other side. She had had to turn out of her own room to accommodate him. But if one kept an apartment house, one had to be adaptable, and Mr. Gooch was certainly very liberal in his ideas. Gooch? An Indian gentleman, I presume, hazarded Carrados. It appeared that Mr. Gooch was an Indian. Miss Chubb confided that at first she had been rather perturbed at the idea of taking in a black man, as she confessed to regarding him. She reiterated, however, that Mr. Gooch proved to be quite the gentleman. 5 minutes of affability put Carrados in full possession of Mr. Gooch's manner of life and movements, the dates of his arrival and departure, his solitariness, and his daily habits.
"This would be the best bedroom," said Miss Chubb.
It was a fair-sized room on the first floor. The window looked out onto the roof of an outbuilding. Beyond, the deep cutting of the railway line. Opposite stood the dead wall that Mr. Carlyle had spoken of. Carrados looked round the room with the discriminating glance that sometimes proved so embarrassing to those who knew him. "I have to take a little daily exercise," he remarked, walking to the window and running his hand up the woodwork. "You will not mind my fixing a developer here, Miss Chubb, a few small screws?" Miss Chubb thought not. Then she was sure not. Finally, she ridiculed the idea of minding with scorn. "If there is width enough," mused Carrados, spanning the upright critically. "Do you happen to have a wooden footrule convenient?"
"Well, to be sure," exclaimed Miss Chubb, opening a rapid succession of drawers until she produced the required article. "When we did out this room after Mr. Gooch, there was this very ruler among the things he hadn't thought worth taking. This is what you require, sir?"
"Yes," replied Carrados, accepting it. "I think this is exactly what I require." It was a common, new, white wood rule, such as one might buy at any small stationer's for a penny. He carelessly took off the width of the upright, reading the figures with a touch, and then continued to run a finger-tip delicately up and down the edges of the instrument. 4 7/8 was his unspoken conclusion.
"I hope it will do, sir."
"Admirably," replied Carrados. "But I haven't reached the end of my requirements yet, Miss Chubb."
"No, sir,"
said the landlady, feeling that it would be a pleasure to oblige so agreeable a gentleman.
"What else might there be?"
"Although I can see very little, I like to have a light, but not any kind of light. Gas I cannot do with. Do you think you would be able to find me an oil lamp?"
"Certainly, sir. I got out a very nice brass lamp that I have specially for Mr. Gooch. He read a good deal of an evening, and he preferred a lamp."
"That is very convenient. I suppose it is large enough to burn for a whole evening?"
"Yes, indeed. And very particular he was always to have it filled every day."
"A lamp without oil is not very useful," smiled Carrados, following her towards another room, and absent-mindedly slipping the foot rule into his pocket. Whatever Parkinson thought of the arrangement of going into second-rate apartments in an obscure street, it is to be inferred that his devotion to his master was sufficient to overcome his private emotions as a self-respecting man. At all events, as they were approaching the station, he asked, and without a trace of feeling, whether there were any orders for him with reference to the proposed migration. "None, Parkinson," replied his master. "We must be satisfied with our present quarters."
"I beg your pardon, sir,"
said Parkinson, with some constraint.
"I understood that you had taken the rooms for a week certain."
"I am afraid that Miss Chubb will be under the same impression. Unforeseen circumstances will prevent our going. However, Mr. Greatorex must write tomorrow, enclosing a cheque with my regrets, and adding a penny for this ruler which I seem to have brought away with me. It, at least, is something for the money. Parkinson may be excused for not attempting to understand the course of events."
"Here is your train coming in, sir,"
he merely said. "We will let it go and wait for another.
Is there a signal at either end of the platform?"
"Yes, sir, at the further end."
"Let us walk towards it."
"Are there any of the porters or officials about here?"
"No, sir, none."
"Take this ruler. I want you to go up the steps. There are steps up the signal, by the way."
"Yes, sir."
"I want you to measure the glass of the lamp. Do not go up any higher than is necessary, but if you have to stretch, be careful not to mark off the measurement with your nail, although the impulse is a natural one. That has been done already." Parkinson looked apprehensively round and about.
Fortunately, the part was a dark and unfrequented spot, and everyone else was moving towards the exit at the other end of the platform. Fortunately, also, the signal was not a high one.
"As near as I can judge on the rounded surface, the glass is 4 7/8 across," reported Parkinson.
"Thank you," replied Carrados, returning the measure to his pocket. 4 7/8 is quite near enough. Now we will take the next train back." Sunday evening came, and with it Mr. Carlyle to the turrets at the appointed hour. He brought to the situation a mind poised for any eventuality and a trenchant eye. As the time went on and the impenetrable Carrados made no allusion to the case, Carlyle's manner inclined to a waggish commiseration of his host's position. Actually, he said little, but the crisp precision of his voice, when the path lay open to a remark of any significance, left little to be said. It was not until they had finished dinner and returned to the library that Carrados gave the slightest hint of anything unusual being in the air. His first indication of coming events was to remove the keys from the outside to the inside of the door.
"What are you doing, Max?"
demanded Mr. Carlyle, his curiosity overcoming the indirect attitude. "You have been very entertaining, Louis," replied his friend, "but Parkinson should be back very soon now, and it is as well to be prepared. Do you happen to carry a revolver?"
"Not when I come to dine with you, Max,"
replied Carlyle, with all the aplomb he could muster.
"Is it usual?"
Carrados smiled affectionately at his guest's agile recovery, and touched the secret spring of a drawer in an antique bureau by his side. The little hidden receptacle shot smoothly out, disclosing a pair of dull, blued pistols. "Tonight, at all events, it might be prudent," he replied, handing one to Carlyle and putting the other into his own pocket. "Our man may be here at any minute, and we do not know in what temper he will come."
"Our man?"
exclaimed Carlyle, craning forward in excitement.
"Max, you don't mean to say that you have got me to admit it?"
"No one has admitted it," said Carrados, "and it is not Mead."
"Not Mead? Do you mean that Hutchins..."
"Neither Mead nor Hutchins, the man who tampered with the signal, for Hutchins was right and a green light was exhibited, is a young Indian from Bengal. His name is Drishna, and he lives at Swanstead." Mr. Carlyle stared at his friend, between sheer surprise and blank incredulity.
"You really mean this, Carrados?"
he said. "My fatal reputation for humour," smiled Carrados. "If I am wrong, Louis, the next hour will expose it."
"But why? Why the colossal villainy, the unparalleled audacity?"
Mr. Carlyle lost himself among incredulous superlatives and could only stare. "Chiefly to get himself out of a disastrous speculation," replied Carrados, answering the question. "If there was another motive, or at least an incentive, which I suspect, doubtless we shall hear of it."
"All the same, Max, I don't think you have treated me quite fairly,"
protested Carlyle, getting over his first surprise and passing to a sense of injury.
"Here we are, and I know nothing, absolutely nothing, of the whole affair."
"We both have our ideas of pleasantry, Louis," replied Carrados genially. "But I dare say you're right, and perhaps there is still time to atone." In the fewest possible words, he outlined the course of his investigations. "And now you know all that is to be known until Drishna arrives."
"But will he come?"
questioned Carlyle doubtfully.
"He may be suspicious."
"Yes, he will be suspicious."
"Then he will not come."
"On the contrary, Louis, he will come because my letter will make him suspicious. He is coming. Otherwise Parkinson would have telephoned me at once, and we should have had to take other measures."
"What did you say, Max?"
asked Carlyle curiously. "I wrote that I was anxious to discuss an Indo-Scythian inscription with him, and sent my car in the hope that he would be able to oblige me."
"But is he interested in Indo-Scythian inscriptions?"
"I haven't the faintest idea," admitted Carrados, and Mr. Carlyle was throwing up his hands in despair, when the sound of motor-car wheels softly kissing the gravel surface of the drive outside brought him to his feet.
"By God, you're right, Max!"
he exclaimed, peeping through the curtains.
"There's a man inside."
"Mr. Drishna,"
announced Parkinson a minute later.
The visitor came into the room with leisurely self-possession that might have been real or a desperate assumption. He was a slightly built young man of about 25, with black hair and eyes, a small, carefully trained moustache, and a dark olive skin. His physiognomy was not displeasing, but his expression had a harsh and supercilious tinge. In attire, he erred towards the immaculately spruce.
"Mr. Carrados?" he said inquiringly.
Carrados, who had risen, bowed slightly, without offering his hand. "This gentleman," he said, indicating his friend, "is Mr. Carlyle, the celebrated private detective." The Indian shot a very sharp glance at the object of this description. Then he sat down.
"You wrote me a letter, Mr. Carrados,"
he remarked, in English that scarcely betrayed any foreign origin.
"A rather curious letter, I may say. You asked me about an ancient inscription. I know nothing of antiquities, but I thought, as you had sent, that it would be more courteous if I came and explained this to you."
"That was the object of my letter," replied Carrados.
"You wish to see me?"
said Drishna, unable to stand the ordeal of the silence that Carrados imposed after his remark. "When you left Miss Chubb's house, you left a ruler behind." One lay on the desk by Carrados, and he took it up as he spoke.
"I don't understand what you are talking about," said Drishna guardedly. "You are making some mistake."
The ruler was marked at 4 7/8 inches, the measure of the glass of the signal lamp outside. The unfortunate young man was unable to repress a start. His face lost its healthy tone. Then, with a sudden impulse, he made a step forward and snatched the object from Carrados's hand.
"If it is mine, I have a right to it,"
he exclaimed, snapping the ruler in two and throwing it onto the back of the blazing fire.
"It is nothing."
"Pardon me. I did not say that the one you have so impetuously disposed of was yours. As a matter of fact, it was mine. Yours is elsewhere."
"Wherever it is, you have no right to it if it is mine,"
panted Drishna, with rising excitement.
"You are a thief, Mr. Carrados. I will not stop any longer here."
He jumped up and turned towards the door. Carlyle made a step forward, but the precaution was unnecessary.
"One moment, Mr. Drishna,"
interposed Carrados in his smoothest tones. "It is a pity, after you have come so far, to leave without hearing of my investigations in the neighbourhood of Shaftesbury Avenue." Drishna sat down again.
"As you like,"
he muttered.
"It does not interest me."
"I wanted to obtain a lamp of a certain pattern," continued Carrados. "It seemed to me that the simplest explanation would be to say that I wanted it for a motor car. Naturally, I went to Long Acre. At the first shop, I said, 'Wasn't it here that a friend of mine, an Indian gentleman, recently had a lamp made with a green glass that was nearly 5 inches across?' No, it was not there. But they could make me one. At the next shop, the same. At the third and fourth, and so on. Finally, my persistence was rewarded. I found the place where the lamp had been made, and at the cost of ordering another, I obtained all the details I wanted. It was news to them, the shopman informed me, that in some parts of India green was the danger colour, and therefore tail lamps had to show a green light. The incident made some impression on him, and he would be able to identify their customer, who paid in advance and gave no address, among 1,000 of his countrymen. Do I succeed in interesting you, Mr. Drishna?"
"Do you?"
replied Drishna, with a languid yawn.
"Do I look interested?"
"You must make allowance for my unfortunate blindness," apologised Carrados, with grim irony.
"Blindness?"
exclaimed Drishna, dropping his affectation of unconcern as though electrified by the word.
"Do you mean really blind? That you do not see me?"
"Alas, no," admitted Carrados. The Indian withdrew his right hand from his coat pocket, and with a tragic gesture flung a heavy revolver down on the table between them.
"I have had you covered all the time, Mr. Carrados, and if I had wished to go, and you or your friend had raised a hand to stop me, it would have been at the peril of your lives,"
he said in a voice of melancholy triumph.
"But what is the use of defying fate, and who successfully evades his destiny? A month ago, I went to see one of our people who reads the future, and sought to know the course of certain events. 'You need fear no human eye,' was the message given to me.
Then she added, "But when the sightless sees the unseen, make your peace with Yama." And I thought she spoke of the great hereafter.
"This amounts to an admission of your guilt," exclaimed Mr. Carlyle, practically.
"I bow to the decree of fate," replied Drishna, "and it is fitting in the universal irony of existence that a blind man should be the instrument. I don't imagine, Mr. Carlyle," he added maliciously, "that you, with your eyes, would ever have brought that result about."
"You are a very cold-blooded young scoundrel, sir," retorted Mr. Carlyle.
"Good heavens, do you realise you are responsible for the death of scores of innocent men and women? Do you realise, Mr. Carlyle, that you and your government and your soldiers are responsible for the deaths of thousands of innocent men and women in my country every day? If England was occupied by the Germans, who quartered an army and an administration with their wives and their families and all their expensive paraphernalia on the unfortunate country until the whole nation was reduced to the verge of famine, and the appointment of every new official meant the callous death sentence on 1,000 men and women to pay his salary, then if you went to Berlin and wrecked a train, you would be hailed a patriot. What Boadicea did, and Samson, so have I. If they were heroes, so am I."
"Well, upon my soul," cried the highly scandalised Carlyle,
"what next? Boadicea was a semi-legendary person, whom we may possibly admire at a distance. Personally, I do not profess to express an opinion, but Samson, I would remind you, is a biblical character. Samson was mocked as an enemy. You, I do not doubt, have been entertained as a friend." "And haven't I been mocked and despised and sneered at every day of my life here by your supercilious, superior, empty-headed men?" flashed back Drishna, his eyes leaping into malignity and his voice trembling with sudden passion. "Oh, how I hated them as I passed them in the street, and recognised by 1,000 petty insults their lordly English contempt for me as an inferior being. A nigger! How I longed with Caligula that a nation had a single neck that I might destroy it at one blow. I loathe you in your complacent hypocrisy, Mr. Carlyle. Despise and utterly abominate you from an eminence of superiority that you can never even understand."
"I think we are getting rather away from the point, Mr. Drishna," interposed Carrados, with the impartiality of a judge. "Unless I am misinformed, you are not so ungallant as to include everyone you have met here in your execration?"
"Ah, no,"
admitted Drishna, descending into a quite ingenuous frankness.
"Much as I hate your men, I love your women. How is it possible that a nation should be so divided, its men so dull-witted and defensive, its women so quick, sympathetic, and capable of appreciating?"
"But a little expensive, too, at times," suggested Carrados. Drishna sighed heavily.
"Yes, it is incredible. It is the generosity of their large nature. My allowance, though what most of you would call noble, has proved quite inadequate. I was compelled to borrow money, and the interest became overwhelming. Bankruptcy was impracticable, because I should then have been recalled by my people. And much as I detest England, a certain reason made the thought of leaving it unbearable."
"Connected with the Arcady Theatre?"
"You knew? Well, do not let us introduce the lady's name. In order to restore myself, I speculated on the Stock Exchange. My credit was good through my father's position and the standing of the firm to which I am attached. I heard on reliable authority and very early that the Central and Suburban, and the Deferred especially, was safe to fall heavily through a motor bus amalgamation, which was then a secret. I opened a bear account and sold largely. The shares fell, but only fractionally, and I waited. Then, unfortunately, they began to go up. Adverse forces were at work and rumours were put about. I could not stand the settlement, and in order to carry over an account, I was literally compelled to deal temporarily with some securities that were not technically my own property."
"Embezzlement, sir," commented Mr. Carlyle icily.
"But what is embezzlement on the top of wholesale murder?"
"That is what it is called. In my case, however, it was only to be temporary. Unfortunately, the rise continued.
Then, at the height of my despair, I chanced to be returning to Swanstead rather earlier than usual one evening, and the train was stopped at a certain signal to let another pass. There was a conversation in the carriage, and I learnt certain details. One said that there would be an accident some day, and so forth. In a flash, as by an inspiration, I saw how circumstances might be turned to account. A bad accident, and the shares would certainly fall, and my position would be retrieved. I think Mr. Carrados has somehow learned the rest. "Max," said Mr. Carlyle with emotion, "is there any reason why you should not send your man for a police officer and have this monster arrested on his own confession without further delay?"
"Pray do so, Mr. Carrados," acquiesced Drishna. "I shall certainly be hanged, but the speech I shall prepare will ring from one end of India to the other. My memory will be venerated as that of a martyr, and the emancipation of my motherland will be hastened by my sacrifice."
"In other words," commented Carrados, "there will be disturbances at half a dozen disaffected places, a few unfortunate police will be clubbed to death, and possibly worse things may happen. That does not suit us, Mr. Drishna."
"And how do you propose to prevent it?" asked Drishna with cool assurance. "It is very unpleasant being hanged on a dark winter morning, very cold, very friendless, very inhuman. The long trial, the solitude and the confinement, the thoughts of the long sleepless night before, the hangman and the pinioning and the noosing of the rope are apt to prey on the imagination. Only a very stupid man can take hanging easily." "What do you want me to do instead, Mr. Carrados?" asked Drishna shrewdly. Carrados's hand closed on the weapon that still lay on the table between them. Without a word, he pushed it across.
"I see," commented Drishna with a short laugh and a gleaming eye. "Shoot myself and hash it up to suit your purpose. Withhold my message to save the exposures of a trial and to keep the flame from the torch of insurrectionary freedom."
"Also," interposed Carrados mildly, "to save your worthy people a good deal of shame, and to save the lady, who is nameless, the unpleasant necessity of relinquishing the house and the income which you have just settled on her. She certainly would not then venerate your memory."
"What is that?"
"The transaction which you carried through was based on a felony, and could not be upheld. The firm you dealt with will go to the courts, and the money, being directly traceable, will be held forfeit, as no good consideration passed."
"Max," cried Mr. Carlyle hotly, "you're not going to let this scoundrel cheat the gallows after all?"
"The best use you can make of the gallows is to cheat it, Louis," replied Carrados. "Have you ever reflected what human beings will think of us 100 years hence?"
"Oh, of course I'm not really in favour of hanging," admitted Mr. Carlyle.
"Nobody really is, but we go on hanging. Mr. Drishna is a dangerous animal who, for the sake of pacific animals, must cease to exist. Let his barbarous exploit pass into oblivion with him. The disadvantages of spreading it broadcast immeasurably outweigh the benefits."
"I have considered," announced Drishna. "I will do as you wish."
"Very well," said Carrados. "Here is some plain notepaper. You had better write a letter to someone saying that the financial difficulties in which you are involved make life unbearable."
"But there are no financial difficulties now."
"That does not matter in the least. It will be put down to an hallucination, and taken as showing the state of your mind."
"But what guarantee have we that he will not escape?"
whispered Mr. Carlyle.
"He cannot escape," replied Carrados tranquilly. "His identity is too clear." "I have no intention of trying to escape," put in Drishna as he wrote. "You hardly imagine that I have not considered this eventuality, do you?"
"All the same," murmured the ex-lawyer, "I should like to have a jury behind me. It is one thing to execute a man morally. It's another to do it almost literally."
"Is that all right?"
asked Drishna, passing across the letter he had written. Carrados smiled at this tribute to his perception.
"Quite excellent," he replied courteously. "There is a train at 9:40. Will that suit you?"
Drishna nodded and stood up. Mr. Carlyle had a very uneasy feeling that he ought to do something, but could not suggest to himself what.
The next moment he heard his friend heartily thanking the visitor for the assistance he had been in the matter of the Indo-Scythian inscription as they walked across the hall together. Then a door closed.
"I believe there is something positively uncanny about Max at times,"
murmured the perturbed gentleman to himself.
End of the Knight's Cross Signal Problem.
Menards is your electrical headquarters. We carry all the tools and testers you need for any electrical job. Stack up your toolbox with Southwire electrical products today. Right now, save big money on Southwire electrical tools, testers, cable ties, wire, and cable. Shop our huge selection in-store at Menards. Ranked number one in customer satisfaction among home improvement retailers according to J.D. Power. For more information, visit jdpower.com/awards.
Save big money at
Find all your 4th of July needs at low prices, all in the Kroger app. Get USDA Choice bone-in tender ribeye steaks for $7.99 a pound with a digital coupon. Limit 5, then buy 2, get 3 free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.